Hey listeners, my fabulous colleagues Amy Bernstein and Amy Gallo are back with a new season of Women at Work. You know, it's your guide to whatever you're facing at work, from anxiety to Gen AI. Listen to new episodes of Women at Work every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Sarah Green. Recently, our editor-in-chief, Adi Ignatius, had the chance to sit down with Christine Lagarde, head of the IMF. They had an incredibly wide-ranging conversation touching on a number of topics. And so this week, we're bringing you some excerpts from that conversation. I hope you enjoy.
So let me just ask you about leadership. You know, I'm interested, you've been in the government, you've worked in the private sector, you're now running a big institution. And I'm interested in your view as to what makes an effective leader and how you can bring change to a culture, and you've been in these various cultures. What have you learned in all these years?
Well, you know, I speak from my own perspective and based on my own experience, and I hate to sort of draw general lessons from what I have gone through and what I've learned myself, because I think every leader has her or his own learnings and experience and all the rest of it. So it's with that, you know, pinch of salt that I'm saying what I'm saying. But I think that I would not have been an effective leader if I had not believed in what I was doing. And I think the first condition is to feel comfortable with the institution, feel comfortable with the strategy that of the mandate, you know, and here we call it a mandate. At Baker McKenzie, we called it the strategy, and in government, I suppose, we called it the program. But I think you have to feel very strongly and sometimes passionate about it. And that's a precondition to being an effective leader. I remember one of my first interviews many, many, many years ago when I was looking for a job, and I was interviewed by a headhunter, and she explained to me that if you were looking for a marketing job, it didn't matter whether you sold a Time magazine or a piece of soap. And I said, I'm sorry, but I will never apply for a marketing job in that case, because I have to feel, you know, for the product, feel for the institution, feel for the mandate, and feel for the objectives. So I think that's condition number one. Condition number two is to just give it all. In other words, to do it wholeheartedly and engaging completely in the mission that you set for yourself. So you can't do a half, you know, it's never a part-time job, it's never a part-of-yourself job. You completely invest yourself in the project that you have. Thing number three is you care about other people, and you care about them understanding the issues, joining in the effort, being part of the team, and drawing some satisfaction from it. I think those would be the three conditions for effective leadership. And then I would rely to two key things, in my view, without which you can't progress. And these two are, number one, energy. If you don't have that vital energy that takes you forward and makes you get up in the morning wanting to achieve something during the day, it's difficult. And number two, confidence. I think you need that to just, you know, stand up in front of either your partners at Baker McKenzie, supporters or members of government, your colleagues, allegedly, or staff in the case of the IMF.
When you come to a great institution, I mean, to what extent are you adapting to a culture, and to what extent as a leader do you feel you have to change a culture?
Combination of both. I think you don't end up in an institution randomly, number one. Number two, I think you are very much determined by your childhood, how you grew up, what values you were taught. And I think my personal journey has been very strongly influenced by the international dimension of it all. My father was professor in university and teaching English, so when we were young kids, we were very often taken to Oxford or Cambridge because he had, you know, swap with other university teachers, professors. And my decisive year was certainly the year that I spent in the United States as an American Field Service student at Holt Noms, which is a sort of a twofold experience of living in a foreign country at the age of 17 without crutches. In other words, you're on your own with a family, with a school, and with a language that you don't know. And second, the American Field Service is a completely international institution where you spend a lot of time with people from Ghana, from Denmark, from China, from Japan, from Peru, and you hang out and deal with issues with them for a full year. And I think that's probably why I feel, you know, very much in tune and in sync with this institution, which is also extremely international, with 163 nationalities in our staff, 188 members in the membership, and where nobody's a clone of anybody else. Everybody is different, and diversity is celebrated.
Okay, so when you came to the IMF then, back to the question of culture, did you feel that there needed to be a cultural change?
I think this institution has unbelievably strong traits. Diversity, being international, being respectful, consulting very much before decisions are made. There's a high degree of intellectual, you don't say condensation, but, you know, I don't think that there are many places in the world where there are so many PhD per square meter, to give you a for instance. So all those are good things, but it's an institution that is also extremely rigid, violently rule-based, which is largely justified, but excesses are never good, and which needs to accept to revisit and review and improve its culture and environment, even with all those great assets, because great assets, if they are not now and again challenged, can become stale. So I try to do that.
So how should we on the outside judge the IMF, whether or not it's
working or not?
Yeah.
You know, another thing which I did this year is raise $461 billion, not including the U.S. The U.S. did not contribute anything. So from the rest of the world, in order to consolidate and strengthen the institution, which is one of the first decisions I made, I thought, okay, well, we need to be stronger. We need to have a bigger wallet, because if things go south, we need to be able to put up with it and give the indication that, yes, we are ready. So that's, I think it's the fact that all countries but the U.S. decided to make those bilateral loans to the institution is a sign of trust to what the mission is and how we go about it. I think that's one. The second, which we need to be accountable for, and when I say we on purpose, because it's not just the management, it's also the membership, is how do we reform our governance? How do we change our quota in order to better reflect the composition of the world and how countries contribute to a global open economy? This is something that we are on our way to delivering on, but we have not delivered yet. So that's the second one. Third one, which I also value, is how much turnover do we have? And more importantly, how many new talents do we attract? Are we regarded as a place of choice for young talent? When economists graduate from LSE, MIT, Harvard, or wherever, do they want to come to the IMF? Money, governance, and talent.
And the sort of the macroeconomic picture that someone like I would look at, you know, whether or not Southern Europe makes it, whether or not global growth comes back to a certain... I mean, do you feel that that is kind of on your balance book as well?
It is, and it is not. It is in the sense that we're here to do surveillance work. In other words, you know, see how the countries are doing and how they can improve their policy mix. And we do give, you know, based on that surveillance mission, we do give guidance. Now, whether that guidance is taken on board, accepted, implemented, depends on our traction. But we have, in a way, traction without teeth when it's a matter of surveillance and guidance. We have teeth when we are lending money to a country. And when we lend money to Ireland, to Portugal, to Greece, to, you know, about 20 African countries, and we say, you should do this, you must do that, you have to satisfy those conditions, you have to do those prior actions. If you don't, well, we can't release the next tranche. It's up to you, but money from the institution, because it is international money and it is lent by your peers around the world, will not be available because it's conditional upon certain things being done. There we have traction and teeth. And I believe that we are making a difference, eventually that we are effective. But what I'm certain of is that it takes time to sink in and then to be recognized. When I traveled to countries in Latin America, when I traveled to countries in Southeast Asia, Asia in general, 10 years ago we had a terrible track record. You talk about Indonesia, you talk about Thailand, you talk about the Philippines and many other countries. The IMF was resented for having prescribed a very harsh set of conditions for those countries to benefit from loans, which then catalyzed additional funding. Now when I go back and I talk to the authorities and the officials, including some of those who have actually negotiated with us in those days, they say, okay, it was hard going. It was very difficult on the country. But thank goodness this was done, and the IMF insisted on that happening, because now we are through with it. We have sanitized and cleaned up our banking system. We have restructured our economy. We've built buffers. We have a much better fiscal policy going forward. So when we act, we are often resented because we are the messenger of truth, and in those situations of bad news, and the prescriber of tough decisions. Then further down the road, generally countries say, okay, well, we didn't like it. In Russia, the authorities said exactly the same thing. Thank goodness you were there at the time when tough decisions had to be made and it needed an external set of books and eyes for us to make those decisions.
Those terms presumably reflect a kind of orthodoxy among your economists in terms of...
They're not Marxist, you mean?
For example.
That's true.
Not currently. But my question really is, you know, to what extent does that orthodoxy change? Or, you know, if you looked back, loans to Indonesia 20 years ago or something, would it be very consistent? Or do you find the IMF has either evolved or tends to be more flexible on a case-by-case basis?
I think it has adjusted and evolved over time. Two examples. IMF used to stand for it's mostly fiscal. I think this is... The fiscal side of a policy mix is still very important. But we also look at the monetary policy, we look at the structural reforms, and we tend to be probably more attentive to what an economy can actually deliver. And the pace of fiscal consolidation that we recommend, for instance, is probably more measured than it has been in the past. I think we pay more attention... Some might say not enough. We pay more attention to the overall environment and the spillover effects, to use, you know, jargonic word, of a set of policies in a given region. And I'm thinking here about the euro area in particular. Second example, I think we include in our sort of checklist and guidelines much more about social safety nets. In other words, when we say to a country, you need to reform your pension system because it doesn't fly, it's much too heavy on your balance sheet and you need to change that, we pay attention to the low end of the pension scheme to make sure that the smaller pensions are better protected and people are sort of have that safety net. Third example, if you compare a program from 20 years ago and a program today, the list of conditions and prior actions is shorter and less specific. In other words, we don't, not that we micromanaged anyway, I wasn't there at the time, but we don't go as much into the details of how the country should do it, what it should do, what topics it should tackle, what measures it should take. We are less specific more generic, if you will, and we give more freedom and space to the country to decide how it is going to pick and choose those measures that will deliver fiscal consolidation, will deliver opening up of the markets, will deliver removal of the turfs and fortresses that have been built in the economy.
This is the great cliche question, but what keeps you up at night? I mean, in terms of the global economy, what are you most worried about?
Well, it varies all the time.
Today? Last night?
Last night I went to sleep like a baby.
China, for example. There's certainly a lot of debate among the economists who follow China that something fundamental might be happening, not simply a cyclical slowdown, but a real challenge to the leaders of the country to be able to kind of regenerate real organic growth. Is China an area of concern now for the IMF?
China is, because of its size, because of its connections both in terms of finance and trade, is obviously high on our list of priorities, not necessarily on our list of alert signals and a strong warning. We are observing a gradual slowdown of an economy that is still growing at a very rapid pace compared with, you know, all the advanced economies. The key question for China is, will it move from the sort of middle-income country stage to an advanced economy? And will it include people in a sufficiently cohesive way so that the social fabric of the Chinese economy and the Chinese society will hold? But I have been dealing with China and going to China many times in the last 20 years. I remember closing our Shanghai office and then opening our Shanghai office back as chairman of Baker McKenzie. And I have been really amazed at how equipped and astute Chinese leadership is. So, of course, you know, you tend to worry and you look at, you know, what will be the policy mix? How are they going to deal with the credit growth? Are they going to keep a leash on the shadow banking? Will they be able to control the financing of municipalities and regional institutions? Will the proclaimed determination to eradicate corruption deliver, and will that happen without massive breakup? All of those are relevant questions, and maybe I'm naturally confident, but I've been mostly impressed by the ability of Chinese leadership to adjust, despite the fact that they operate as groups. There's not one single guy who's going to decide, as happens in other countries of the world. It's a laborious collegial governance that seemed to adjust quite well.
And it looks like our time is up, but I do want to say, so you have a 5-year term.
Yeah.
I guess expires in
2016.
What happens to Madame Lagarde after that?
She will look after her grandchildren.
Okay.
Or do something else. I have no idea. I've never made career plans in my life, so.
All right, thank you.
All right.
That was head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, and HBR editor-in-chief, Adi Ignatius. For more, including some different excerpts from the interview, visit hbr.org.